This is the Yale University Press podcast. I'm Claire Barnes, one of the hosts of the podcast, covering our books on the environment, politics, religion, history, law, and biography. I'm excited to welcome our guest today, Michael S. Roth, president of Wesleyan University and longtime author with Yale University Press. His previous books on education with the press include Beyond the University, Why Liberal Education Matters, and Safe Enough Spaces, A Pragmatist Approach to Inclusion, Free Speech, and Political Correctness on College Campuses. Today, we're here to talk with Roth about his recent book with Yale University Press, The Student, A Short History. Plus, we'll discuss the challenges and joys of education today. Welcome, Michael, to the podcast.
Great to be here, Claire.
So first, you know, The Student is a broad intellectual history from the 6th century BCE to the present. You begin with the followers of Confucius, Socrates, and Jesus, moving through to the students of the Enlightenment and 21st century universities. Tell us about a pivotal moment in your own life as a student. Did you have an influential teacher or learning experience that made you want to pursue a career in academia?
Oh, yes. Like lots of perpetual students, I was very much influenced by wonderful teachers. I was very fortunate to stumble upon great teachers, mostly beginning with Wesleyan, I was an undergraduate in the 1970s. I had an extraordinary advisor in intellectual history named Henry Abeloff, who went on to become one of the founders of queer theory and a great force for good things at Wesleyan and way beyond. And in philosophy, worked very closely with Viktor Gurevich, and he was an important influence on me. Both of them counseled me as I was leaving college to not go to graduate school if I expected to get a job. Each of them emphasized that they thought I would never get a job in academia. And Victor said that I should only go to graduate school if I could get someone else to pay for it, like, you know, fellowship, and that I should only go to continue my education. I remember he had a very deep voice. And I went to see Henry Abeloff, who was a kind of a sweeter, kinder person on the surface and beyond. and I said, well, I think I want to go to grad school. I had gotten a job at Yale at the psychiatric hospital at the time, but I had gotten interested in pursuing academics. And Henry said, well, you know, only 1% of people going to graduate school are going to get decent jobs. And I said, well, but if I work really hard and I strive, and maybe I'll be in the 1%. And he said something like, that, my dear, is a bourgeois myth. And which at Wesleyan in those days was the worst thing you could be told. And so I licked my wounds and really decided to go because when I talked to my father, who didn't go to college, who was worked in the fur industry, when I told him about it, he said, well, if you don't go, you'll always wonder whether you could have gone or should have gone. So if it doesn't work out, I had an uncle who was a cab driver. He said he could help you out. I had a job in a kitchen in college. I knew how to make a little money. And so I went. And then at Princeton, where I went to graduate school, I didn't like the ambiance, but I had wonderful teachers in Natalie Davis in history and Arno Mayer in history, Sheldon Wolin in political theory, and especially Dick Rorty in philosophy, and my Dr. Vater, Karl Schursky, the great historian of Vienna, who really helped me enormously stop worrying about where I belonged in academia and just start trying to do something that I enjoyed doing intellectually. And that was a great gift, and we became great friends. So those teachers really were decisive for me, and I've spent a lot of time writing about them, actually. I've written about Schursky, and I've written about, I wrote a book with Viktor Gurevich, and 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 Hayden White was a teacher of mine. And so I've spent a lot of time wrestling with what I learned from those great teachers, trying to live up to their example.
Thanks for sharing a little bit about your own experience with learning and the great teachers that have influenced you. I want to turn now to your three books that you've had with the press. And in these books, and you've contemplated the role of the university as an echo chamber of civic issues. Can you paint our listeners a picture of how your thought process evolved throughout these texts and landed in the current moment with your book, The Student?
Sure. So I didn't write about education very much before taking on Beyond the University, the first book I did with Yale. I'd spent most of my career writing about European intellectual history and a book on French Hegelianism, a book on psychoanalysis, and then a couple of books about trauma and representation in history, kind of memory studies issues. And, you know, being a president of a university, I don't have a lot of time to do the kind of research I used to do for those books, which involved going to France and spending a lot of time in an archive or a library. And so I in about 2012, probably, maybe even a little earlier, I got very agitated, is probably the best word, by the debates in higher education. And they were around MOOCs at the time, and a lot of people saying that it was going to be the end of college. That was the title of a book. And there are a lot of people making a fair amount of noise about how college was going to go away. Most of them were not teachers, actually, but more commentators. And I started teaching online myself, and I thought it was really interesting, and I still do think it's interesting. But I didn't think it meant the end of residential colleges and universities. So I started to think about how I could not just opine, you know, in the newspapers and magazines about these issues, but create a context, a historical context for the development of a liberal education in a pragmatic way. And so Dick Rorty had a lot of influence on me as a thinker and as a teacher. And so when I started to think about writing about education, pragmatism was very much on my mind. And so that Beyond the University book was an attempt to chart out a separate stream of thinking about liberal education, or what most people would call liberal arts education, in the American context. And I made that the pragmatist context. So my heroes are, you know, Emerson and Du Bois and Jane Addams and Dewey, and Dick Rorty to some extent. And so it is an intellectual history. So that's what I knew how to write. I had never written about American intellectual history. In fact, I had never studied it. And so I was quite worried that I'd make some stupid mistake. But it was a fun book to write. And then Safe Enough Spaces came out of just me writing a lot of opinion pieces and book reviews, again, about this is the debates around free speech and affirmative action and what we now call equity and inclusion. Those debates, it seemed to me, were thinner historically than they should be, that many people were saying stuff and writing bestsellers by just repeating the tired tropes of criticisms of young people that have been around for quite some time. I was interested in, I've seen since the 1960s, and how the term politically correct changed over time, how this notion of free speech got co-opted by a libertarian ideology that was more tied to free market economics than it was to expressivity. And so Safe Enough Spaces was my effort to bring those concerns together into a book about the current scene in higher education, where we I think have to defend free speech, but we don't have to be naive about the harms that have been inflicted, especially on marginalized groups and on women over time. Because we don't have to be blind to that just because we defend free speech. We can actually be aware of those issues and still have a commitment to freedom of inquiry, freedom of speech. You know, as a pragmatist, I can't say things like, oh, when we get to the truth that way, because, you know, we pragmatists don't think we get to something called truth with the big T. But I was able to situate these debates in recent intellectual history. And then my editor at Yale, my wonderful editor at Yale, Jennifer Banks, said, you know, I have this idea about doing something on the student, and maybe you're the guy to write this book. And, you know, you want to send us a proposal how you would approach something about the idea of the student. And so I, again, thinking, I suppose, genealogically, I'm interested in contemporary students. Well, where did these ideas about contemporary students come from? I thought it would be fun to write about iconic teachers to start, since I'm so indebted to my own teachers. I chose three. You know, they could be other ones. Of course, people ask you, why didn't you choose Moses? Or what about Muhammad? Or, you know, there are a lot of, or other figures. Of course, one could have. And so, I approach this as an intellectual historian, but as you pointed out, over a very long period of time. And so, I'm not a medieval historian. I did write about the medieval period. I got help from colleagues. Some colleagues told me, there's no way you could possibly do it. I can't help you. Other people just said, read these things, and that was useful. And so, again, I wanted to chart the changing idea of what it meant to be a student, to graduate from the status of being a student. And then in the last 100 or so years, what does it mean to be a college student in America, and how that's changed, and what we expect from that period in people's lives today, that period of being a student.
The student, it really does move through the time periods that we've talked about quite gracefully. And I think it's an easy read. It's a great read. Yet to expand on the crises of higher education in this century and situating contemporary issues historically, I'm wondering if you can give an example where global politics, you know, caused mass structural change to how we think about the role of education in society, and what lessons from that example can we take into the present moment?
Well, two come to mind just off the top of my head. One would be the French Revolution, and then the extraordinary immigration to the United States in the second decade or so and beginning of the 20th century. So let's start with the French Revolution. A turning point in this little book called The Student, Short History, is the Enlightenment, as you pointed out in the introduction, I focus on Kant's idea of enlightenment being freedom from self-imposed immaturity. It's a great idea. It gets played out in the ideologies around the French Revolution, which for some people showed the folly of the idea of enlightenment or freedom from self-imposed immaturity, because some people, they grabbed freedom, but they didn't lose their immaturity, and the result was chaos and violence, at least from a conservative point of view. Other people argued that masses of people were coming into their own and were taking charge of their own lives, and they would do so much more successfully if they were educated, and that education was a foundational element of freedom. And so that you could, if freedom without education was license or just appetite, Rousseau called it the first idea of freedom, which is like, so you pee wherever you want, basically. That's that kind of freedom. But the higher freedom was moral freedom, which you could only attain by coming into your own intellectually, which just simply means thinking for yourself in the company of others. And so in the wake of the French Revolution, in France and in Germany, or German-speaking Europe, there arises an extraordinary dedication to education as Bildung, as character formation, as the development of a person's ability to be free. And that's the theme of the second half of The Student, that being a student is practicing freedom. And by practicing freedom, you become less inclined to just wanting to be able to pee wherever you want. The childish notion that freedom is, you're not the boss of me, you know, I could do what I want. That's the primitive version or the juvenile version of freedom. The freedom as thinking for yourself and the company of others, that idea emerges through education. And so I think the massive events of the French Revolution and the wars that followed it really instigate many thinkers and institutions to dedicate themselves to understanding learning as a practice of freedom. And then in a different mode, in the United States, in colleges and universities in the beginning of the 1900s, they're faced with two things that have to change the character of colleges and universities. The first is that women are going to have access, and that, you know, in some public institutions, even let's say in Michigan, there are more women than men going to the university right away. They start, you know, flocking to universities. And I do think it's because women realize quite quickly that it is a practice of freedom, and the unfreedom of patriarchy cannot be totally undone by education, but it is attenuated by education. And so colleges and universities adjusted to having women. Sometimes they kicked them out, like they did at Wesleyan. We had women for about, you know, a generation or two of students, and then they got rid of the women because they were afraid that men were, well, maybe they seemed to be afraid that men couldn't keep up, really. But that's another story. But institutions began to change. The other thing that really forces people to change is all these immigrants who come from Eastern Europe and Southern Europe in the early decades of the 1900s, who see education as a vehicle for social mobility. Whereas before, education was a vehicle for, making your club a little bit better appointed. You learned how to be part of the club, which you had access to already. In the 20s and 30s, as so many more immigrants go to colleges and universities to advance their prospects in the world, college and universities have to adjust. The kind of old WASP elite has to adjust, and they find themselves competing with these Jews and others who are heading off to colleges and universities. You know, colleges and universities, they at the elite schools, they create quotas so they keep these people out. But I do think colleges and universities shifted away, not entirely, but in part away from this idea of a finishing school or just a kind of polishing up of the old boy network into something else, a launch pad for thinking for yourself in the company of others.
Thanks for those two examples, which are fascinating for a moment today in thinking about both freedom and thinking for yourself in the company of others. As you said, on the topic of freedom, you know, you've been a prominent commentator in recent congressional hearings on free speech and anti-Semitism on college campuses, and not only in your writing, but on national news as well. How have you seen opposing views on global conflict play out in your own classroom and campus? What type of freedoms would you like to see emerge from these conversations?
Well, thank you for that question. It's a really important one. I'm an old guy now, so I teach. I may be set in my ways as a teacher, so I'll describe to you what happens in my classroom. But I don't know that that's like the best way for people to do it. Everybody's so different. As you know, teachers, teaching is such an embodied practice that it works. Things work differently for different teachers, and of course there are different kinds of students. In my case, shortly after October 7th in 2023, one of my students asked if we could talk about what was happening in Gaza and in the Mideast more generally in class. This was a class on modernism and postmodernism, a class I teach it pretty often at Wesleyan. And it's a great books course. We start with Kant and Rousseau, and we end with Saidiya Hartman, and Maggie Nelson. So that's, it's a very strong text for 14 weeks. Anyway, I said, no, we're not going to talk about Gaza in the Middle East. That you can talk to your friends about that. You can talk to, and there are professors who have points of view, but it's not something that I feel I have expertise to offer. But we are reading Civilization and its Discontents this week. which is Freud's great text about the almost necessary resurgence of violence, no matter what goes on, it looks like progress, that human beings scapegoat each other, other human beings, and get enormous satisfaction of inflicting pain on other people. And that the kumbaya call for peace or the kumbaya criticism of violence was doomed to just produce more violence in Freud's view. So although we weren't talking about what was happening in the Middle East, the process of scapegoating, of othering, of aggressivity not going away, that was everywhere in the text, everywhere in our minds as we grappled with Freud's arguments. And I think that was a good way for the students to learn about things in a tradition that were still relevant to what was happening on campus. The what I hope happens from that kind of experience is that students get a better sense of the complexity of the issues, and that reasonable people have very different perspectives on those issues. And then they might learn something from listening to people whose views are different from their own. This, of course, is kind of an obvious thing, but it's not such a prevalent thing on college campuses today, where there has been a tendency in many schools for students to shut out voices they think are inappropriate or just wrongheaded, for faculty members to funnel information in a way that doesn't allow students to see the complexity of issues. I can't tell you how many times my students ask me, what is your own view about X? Or what is your own view about a work of art? I go, which one do you like better? They'll often say, and I try very hard not to gratify their curiosity, their desire to know about those such things, because I try to get them to see it doesn't matter what I think. It doesn't actually matter what they think. What matters is these great works of art and texts that we're wrestling with that can inform their points of view about the complexity of issues. And I think when people have a deeper view of the complexity of issues, they're more likely to find a productive path forward. That last part, you know, is a kind of liberal, a bourgeois myth, maybe Henry Abeloff would tell me, but I think it's the best we can do in education is to give students this ability to practice freedom by practicing tolerance, good listening skills, the ability to say things and then take them back, actually to make a claim and then realize it's the wrong claim and say, okay, I learned something. It's rather than being ashamed of being wrong, being grateful that you know you were wrong before. And we try to model that in class so that students are less fearful. And I hope that spills over into the campus. And I have met with groups of students here at Wesleyan and occasionally elsewhere to try to get a sense of how fearful are they. You know, commentators talk about self-censorship a lot, and you know, newspapers love to publish accounts by students who say, I've been silenced. You know, they paradoxically, here they are in the paper talking about being silenced. But I try to empower students to be less afraid of speaking out. Now, I should say that many of at Wesleyan students speak out against the administration, and I represent the administration, so they're often speaking out against me, and that's part of the. That's part of the game, I understand that. But I do think that right now, when the tendency to put people into silos is so strong, and the tendency for students themselves to put themselves into silos is so strong, I think it's really important to create possibilities of communication across difference. Just this morning, I was reading an article in the Chronicle of Higher Education about how some schools are advertising themselves as a safe place for, you know, fill in the blank. And Brandeis Brandeis was for years was saying, we're not that Jewish, you know, we're we're a regular university for Jews, but not so Jewish, you know. And now they're like, hey, Jews are unwelcome everywhere. Jews are welcome here at Brandeis. You know, I understand the marketing dimension of that claim, but it is a, I think it's a sad claim. It's a pathetic claim to say you should come here because there are people like you here. I tell the students when I meet with them in the spring for, you should go to a school where there are people not like you. If you think you come to Wesleyan because there are people like you, please don't come here. Go to Williams. You find people, you know, who are, go to a place where you expect to find people like yourself. Wesleyan should be a place, a real great school should be a place where you encounter folks with different points of view, different life experiences, and different commitments, whether they're political commitments or religious commitments or other kinds, identity commitments. So I do think that there's a strong tendency towards sameness, that we should, as educators, we should push against.
That's so fascinating. There's a lot of things I'm fascinated about in your answer there. One is the really high standards of perfectionism that both students and college administrators are held to at the risk of cancellation. I found that interesting in the hearings, and thinking about that in the current crisis. Do you have any thoughts on, you know, should we be thinking about perfectionism in academia in the challenges? No?
You know, I think the hearing was abysmal. I think it wasn't about perfectionism. It was about, right, it was about a public display of stupidity and cowardice. And you could say, okay, they screwed up. They were set up. They screwed up. And they can, you know, they should be able to make amends. And I guess I, you know, I feel that way because I'm sure they're good people, actually, and quite capable. They don't have to be perfect. My sense is, and I don't know these situations in great detail, but my sense is at Penn there were problems between the president and some of the boards and the big donors before the hearing. And at Harvard, there the plagiarism issues, you know, exacerbated the situation. And at MIT, although her answers weren't really any better, you know, they could say, well, yeah, you did badly in Washington. You said you did badly. You apologize, and then you go on. And that seems to me, you know, I think that's a very reasonable approach. I think what happened, the other two cases, is that they were very strong voices with lots of money that that pushed back against the leaders in place, and that there were other problems that they were able to uncover. So I don't want to defend the particular record of other of the presidents. I don't know them, but I do know that the people who went after them are also folks who would have a censor pro-Palestinian discourse on campus. They would have us. They would compromise academic freedom. And so I find that the victory of those voices that will want to send universities backward, the victory of those voices is terrible. But I don't think that's about perfectionism so much as about the forces of, especially on the right, that were able to find damning information about some of the presidents, not all of them. But if the information is damning, you know, you have to deal with that. That's that, even if a bad guy found it, it's still real information. So I have mixed feelings about that. I do think defending our commitments to diversity are really important these days in the face of this kind of backlash we see around the country. But it has to include intellectual diversity and not just, you know, identity diversity. I do think identity diversity is also important. But I was on a panel at Brown a month ago or so about affirmative action decision by the Supreme Court, and there were four of us, I think, on the panel, and we were all very critical of the decision. We were all very much in favor of affirmative action with race, and we all were saying how important diversity is. So I said, well, it's kind of a paradox here. There is no diversity among us. We're all of the same view, more or less. And so we say diversity is important, but we don't have anybody here, even though most Americans are against race-based affirmative action. Most Black Americans are against race-based affirmative action. We don't have anybody making that case here. And they seem quite offended by that, actually. But it seemed to be a kind of obvious blind spot that we had on the panel, that we didn't have someone willing to, you know, make a case for the negative effects of race-based affirmative action. And I didn't want to do that because I don't have that view myself, but I know there are smart people who do have that view. And so I think we have to work harder at creating curating a conversation where there are many different perspectives.
Right. And there, you know, were a lot of moving parts in the congressional hearing you mentioned. And I came across a term through a Times Higher Education article called pluralistic campuses, which I think may get to what you're talking about. And I'd love to talk more about that. And, you know, the article included several concrete steps to building pluralistic campuses, which, you know, the authors argued can build leaders to address these divisions within our nation. And some of these steps included presidential commitment to pluralism, pluralistic fellowships involving students, and crisis planning. How involved do you think college presidents should be in this process?
I think we should be very involved. This is Eboo Patel's project, right? I'm a great admirer of Eboo's, and I heard him give it the talk that I guess resulted in that article. And I'm creating presidential pluralist fellows here. And I think I called him up and said, who else is doing this? And he said, well, who do you want us to add? So I think it's kind of it's early days, but I think it's a great idea. I think he's right. There's an intellectual tradition to build on there. He and I have talked about it. We think it's that pragmatist tradition, actually, that because you need pluralism for pragmatism to work. And I think presidents have to play a role because my experience is the faculty tend to think in departmental terms and as a whole, my conversations with faculty members have not, how should I put this with that? I'm hesitating because I guess I'm thinking, I've had great conversations with faculty about the importance of intellectual diversity, but if I hadn't raised it, it wouldn't come up. And so, I have colleagues here at Wesleyan, and I'm sure it would be the same at Yale and other places. I have colleagues who think my concern with this is really misplaced in a period of great backlash and, you know, transphobia and racist politicians, that me calling for more conservative voices or more pluralism on campus, that's a mistake. I think, you know, that's what we should talk about. I mean, and so that becomes the part of the conversation. But I do think that presidents are in a position, it doesn't have to be the president, but presidents are in a position to encourage this kind of curation. And then that empowers students and faculty who might otherwise feel too marginalized to speak up. And that's what I found here at Wesleyan. Now there are now student articles in the college newspaper about the importance of viewpoint diversity. We've made some hires that push back against the tendency, I think, that folks have to hire people like themselves. We know that's a bias. So I've asked my colleagues to just think about whether their notion that they're choosing the best person, they just happen to have the same politics, that may be a form of bias. And I've said to my colleagues that when I was a graduate student, we were trying to get the faculty to hire more women. And they said things to us like, well, we would love to, but we want to hire the best people. They just happen to be these white guys like us. And I think my faculty colleagues sound a lot like that when they say, well, we hire another anthropologist, and they also want to teach a course on settler colonialism. And they also, everybody's doing they have the same view as I have. Or I hear they're not exactly the same view. They're nuanced. So I think presidents can play a role here.
Yeah. And I think the, you know, curation, as you said, or creation of pluralistic campuses with both students and faculty in this landscape is a really strong vision for the future of higher education. And I'd like to turn now to, as we, you know, come to the end of the podcast, your vision for academia and learning in the future. I know pluralistic campuses might be a part of that, you know, but will we move towards different structures of student-teacher relationships? Will we see an increase in experiential learning or hands-on learning? You know, perhaps any vision of a utopia is somewhat practical, but what do you envision?
So I think that there's no single educational system in the United States, let alone beyond our borders. There's so many different modes of education. And I think the most important thing to do is to improve our K-12 systems, which are, you know, still reproducing inequality at an extraordinary rate. You know, literacy rates among in high poverty areas are abysmal, and support for teachers in elementary school instruction is just horrid. And so a great place to start improving education would be to support K-12, especially K-4, pre-K through fourth grade education, to give people the ability to read and then to articulate their own views, which enable them to think in the company of others more creatively and productively. At the college level, I think we need more translators. When you have translators, you don't have silos. You have people who can communicate about why chemistry and engineering would benefit from having more interpretive skills that you might learn in the humanities classes, or why people in the humanities classes might benefit from thinking about ethical issues that arise in the sciences, or and so on and so on. And so I think that our great enemy in colleges and universities, especially elite ones like Yale and Wesleyan, is the specialization that academics are incentivized to pursue, which isolate them from one another, and it isolates them from the general public. And so they cannot, the professors can't understand the public, and the public cannot understand the professors. What we need instead is that are people who are capable of going deep in their own subject area and also able to talk to their students as teachers and to the public as citizens. And so my hope for higher education is that we will be welcoming students who are more capable when they start, and that what they learn when they're college students are skills they could take beyond the university. I don't think it should just be having a great 4 years or 3 years or 5 years, whatever it is, but that they go beyond the university with their skills to be better citizens and to find meaningful work.
Thanks for that response. I think it was great to bring it back to K-12 as a foundation, and then to move to a vision for cultivating communicators in our universities, to then move outside of the university, move outside of the campus. So thanks so much for your insights there. And as we're nearing the end of our conversation, is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you'd like to share with our listeners, specifically about the book, The Student, or just in general, a message for students and teachers today?
Well, I just really want to emphasize that education is a public good, and that it gives you private powers, you know, skills, may lead to a good job, one hopes, but it's a public good. And what we need a more educated citizenry to make better choices in the public sphere. Over the next 6-7 months, we're going to see a really important series of elections culminating in November. And I think for college students and all students who are of voting age, to actually understand that the only way this country is going to get better is if they participate in the public sphere, and that they use the education, that public good of education, on behalf of the nation, on behalf of the country, but on behalf of those who are not able to articulate for themselves what they need, but also to create a more responsive, more just a public sphere. If educated people turn their noses up at elections or at the public sphere, it's only going to get worse. It's broken. It's corrupt now. We need college professors and administrators and students to participate in the public sphere, especially in the coming months.
Thank you so much, Michael, for taking the time to join us on this episode of the Yale University Press podcast. This has been a fascinating discussion, and I encourage our listeners to grab a copy of The Student if they're interested in learning more.
Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
The Student, A Short History by Michael S. Roth, is available wherever books are sold. Thank you so much for listening. Please visit us online at yalebooks.com for more episodes of the podcast, as well as information about all of our books.